Welcome to the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow, live from the Westfield Insurance Studio Theater at WCPN Idea Stream in Cleveland. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Elections are about a lot of things, but they come down to this, Kai, numbers. So, as we say, let's do the numbers.
All right, very well. We have 35 days until the election as of today. Your state, Ohio, is what they call, wait, what? Oh, yeah, a swing state, right? Which means it must be nice, all those ads telling you what you need to know in the most truthful, direct, and honest way, right?
In fact, Kai, Ohio ranks number two in the race for TV spots. $112 million have been spent in this state so far. The state getting even more ads than you also happens to be the state where the new Ohio State football coach used to coach, which would be Florida.
Florida. And since we are keeping score, almost half of the money being spent on ads here are coming from outside groups. Super PACs with names that sound honestly like a workout video, right? Restore Our Future, Joe Sixpack, that's it. That's an honest one. Priorities USA, just to name a couple.
So what does all this mean for you? We are going to explain the economics behind getting your vote and what issues you should be paying attention to in this election when you hear these familiar voices.
We can choose a future where we export more products and outsource fewer jobs. After a decade that was defined by what we bought and borrowed, we're getting back to basics and doing what America's always done best. We are making things again.
That America, that united America, can unleash an economy that will put Americans back to work, that will once again lead the world with innovation and productivity, and that will restore every father and mother's confidence that their children's future is brighter even than the past.
Governor Romney, of course, and President Obama, you guys here in Ohio have probably heard them more than you care to. I will tell you, in California, nothing. It's like crickets. It's the craziest thing. Not that I'm complaining about that, of course. Elections usually have a theme, right? National security, foreign affairs. This time around, everybody all together now, it's the economy, right? There you go. Stupid. Who said stupid, right? Jobs, taxes, the deficit, and the middle class.
And Kai, in Ohio, those issues are front and center. The unemployment rate here, by the way, is 7.2%, which a lot of states would kill for. That's a full percent lower than the national average. But what is even more important, of course, is the story behind those numbers. And that is why we're here today. And we're going to be traveling across the country over the next 4 weeks leading up to Election Day, taking the time to explain what often gets passed along as talking points.
This election is about so many things that are so much more important than who's in front, in which poll, by how much. It's not the horse race that matters. It's not the horse race that matters. It is the economy. But riddle me this. What does that even mean, really? So tonight, the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow. We're off and running. Thanks for being here. Numbers and statistics and campaign ads can only tell you so much.
Because when you walk into that voting booth, it is just you and your hopes about the future.
Lynn Vavrick, joining us here on the stage, is the director of the Center for the Study of Campaigns at the University of California, Los Angeles. She is also, serendipitously, a native of this very city. So how about that? Welcome home. I know, right?
Thanks, Kai.
How about that? How about that for an introduction? Which gets us to this first question. You ready?
I'm ready.
What is it about Ohio, man? Why do we always have to talk about you guys?
I can't even believe this is a question.
Yeah.
Political candidates.
No, give me the real answer.
They love the Browns.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, come on. I think it's an interesting question. Is there something special about the people here that make Ohio a swing state or a battleground? Or is it just the random drawing of arbitrary geographic lines that encompasses this set of people? And I think the way to think about it is that the state is uniquely proportioned. We have the northeastern part that is industrial, the southern part that is more technological, and a little agrarian in the middle. And those sets are in relatively equal balance. So that means it tips.
Let me offer you this suggestion, and then I'll let Jeremy climb in here. Is it possible you guys just can't make up your minds? right?
I think that's not it, honestly.
Right.
I think we could ask people whether it's more difficult for them, you know, and compared to what we had last week in California or next week in Boston, and I bet it's the same.
And is it all about the economy here for those undecided voters, for those independent voters who have not made up their, who are not going to just go with one party or another? What are they thinking about?
I think that there's been a lot of attention to these undecided voters in the last week or two. And truthfully, as you might suspect, the closer we get to Election Day, more of them are making up their minds. And generally speaking, they will make up their minds the same way that everyone else has previously made up their mind. They just come to it a little later. They're not paying as much attention. It's not as important to them.
Wait. So how do people make up their minds? I mean, do they watch the advertising? Do they pay attention to the money that's being spent? I mean, how do people come to the decisions they come to in politics?
Well, the number one thing, the first thing, really, if I were a betting person, I would bet on their party identification. So Democrats tend to vote for Democrats, Republicans for Republicans.
Yeah.
And
Shocking.
I know. It's science. Right? You only hear it at Marketplace.
You have a PhD in that, right?
Yeah, exactly. They paid me to do this. So a lot of undecided voters have party identification. They're not all independents. So the first thing is to separate being an independent from being undecided. A lot of undecided folks have party identification. Okay, second thing is the state of the nation's economy. Not the unemployment rate, not the level of unemployment or growth, but the change. How are we trending?
So if you're going after those voters as a candidate, where do you spend your money in a state like this? What is the best way to reach those people? Is it just TV advertising?
TV, I hate to say it, but TV advertising is a great way to reach a lot of people. And that's why they do it.
Okay, wait, hang on. How many of you have just flat tuned out all the advertising? Right? Yeah. All right, so there's like two people who didn't raise their hands. They're spending all that money for those two people.
Okay, but brace yourself, because if Mitt Romney stopped, he would fall in the polls.
And if he stopped spending money in advertising.
And Barack Obama kept advertising in Ohio, Romney would, quote unquote, lose market share. Right. So the reason that you've got this high level of advertising by both campaigns is that they need to stay at the same level of advertising. It's like McDonald's and Burger King. If McDonald's stops advertising, they're going to lose market share. It's the same thing in politics.
And what's the message that's going to work this year for these Ohio voters that's different from a voter in New Hampshire or one of the other swing states?
That's the thing that I think is also really interesting. Even though in California we don't get all the ads, it's the same message that works. There's nothing special about Cleveland or Columbus that is different from Los Angeles or San Francisco when you're in the economic context and the global context that we're in. It's the same message.
Let me ask you one other question here. I interviewed the former governor, Ted Strickland, of Ohio. He's going to be on the show later this week. And he made a lot of hay. Of course, he's a Democrat. But he made a lot of hay about this 47% Mitt Romney comment. Is that the kind of thing that that really matters to Ohio voters?
Yeah, does it resonate, right? Yeah.
I think that, you know, it's unlikely that a single moment like that is a turning point in any campaign. We could sit here and list hundreds of them, and it's unlikely that they turned any election. But in this particular election, that comment coming in this long line of comments that reinforced the idea of Mitt Romney as rich and insensitive, that really was part of a narrative that is being constructed about him, and I think is quite damaging.
Can I get you, we got about a minute and a half left. Can I get you back to your prior point about it's not the absolute state of the economy, it's the changing trend over time. Is that why Romney's not running away with this thing? I mean, because you look at the numbers and you're like, I don't understand how Obama's still neck and neck with this guy.
That is exactly right. So everybody wants to say, oh, you know, Romney should really have this election sewn up because the economy is in the dumper. But if you just stop for a minute and look at the trends, the economy is growing. It's growing slowly, but it is growing. And incumbents in growing economies, even slow-growing economies, are very hard to beat. And so this really is Obama's election to lose.
One more thing then, Lynn. Why are the candidates making appearances in Ohio. Does that retail politicking matter in this?
Yeah, so it's a great question. They come, they visit, and you know, you just have to ask yourself, again, why so much advertising? Because who's likely to go to that Romney rally in Strongsville or the Obama rally downtown? Someone who's already interested in Romney or Obama.
Right.
Very few undecided or uncommitted voters are stumbling on a Romney rally. So it really reinforces people's pre-existing proclivities.
Anybody been to a rally, by the way? Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Oh, like, really? Only three people?
Wow. All right. Good. Lynn Vavreck is the director of the Center for the Campaigns, for the Study of Campaigns, rather, at UCLA. Her book is called The Message Matters, The Economy and Presidential Campaigns. Lynn, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
So listen, Jeremy.
Yeah?
There's this thing I've been wondering, man.
All right.
Why?
Why what?
Why do people vote the way they do?
It's a good question. It's kind of maybe a complicated question for our one-hour format here.
So we'll take like 6 minutes, and we'll talk to this guy. His name is Ryan Enos. He's an assistant professor of government at Harvard University. He studies quantitative social science. And so the first question, of course, is, the heck is quantitative social science?
That's a good question. I think we argue about that a lot ourselves.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. We use numbers to find out about human beings and human life and things like elections.
So let's talk about what exactly it is that you study. Lynn was talking about economy and campaigns and elections. You study income inequality. You study people and their neighborhoods and how they are influenced, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we look at where a person lives, how that affects how they vote. Mm-hmm. Who they vote for, whether or not they vote, and especially who they live around. So whether you live around a person that is different than you or whether you live around a person that's the same as you. And what we find is that has a tremendous influence on how you vote.
So you're saying that I would care how my neighbor votes or whether my neighbor votes. That's going to make an impact on whether I am going to vote.
Yes, absolutely. So what we find is that people, it all comes down to identity. So if you identify with your neighbors and your neighbors vote, that is likely to make you vote. At the same time, the very strange flip side of it is if you don't identify your neighbors, they're from maybe another group, a different racial group, a different income group, something like that, and you think they're voting, that is likely to make you vote because you feel a sense of competition with you. And this may even affect who you vote for.
Go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to say, does that help explain why Ohio is a swing state? I mean, Lynn laid it out, right? We've got agrarian, we've got semi-industrial, we've got, you know, all kinds of things. Does that explain why this state gets so much attention every 4 years?
Well, it very well could. It could be part of it because what you'll find is that voters here, they can play off that sort of competition as well, and the candidates can play off that. They can look at the voters here and say, well, we're going to try to take the voters in our camp and have them play off the voters in a different camp. You look at a place like Cleveland, there's a tremendous racial mix here, a tremendous mix of ethnicities, of incomes, and things like that, and it does bring a balance and a competition that candidates can use.
Let me make sure I understand this. Campaigns consciously use us against each other.
There is some evidence for that, absolutely.
Wow. You know, that's so cynical.
It is cynical, but you know, they're trying to do something very important. They're trying to win the most important office in the whole world, and so they're going to do what they can. And you know, they won't come out and admit it, of course, but there's evidence for this. If you look at things like Mitt Romney's welfare ads, which of course you know people in Ohio have probably seen 1,000 times, there's a lot of evidence that those were tapping into people's attitudes about different types of people, about different racial groups and things like that.
Wow. So how is that likely to play out then this year, do you think, in the state of Ohio? Where is that going to make a difference?
Well, there is some evidence that there's a lot of voters out there that are very motivated by their racial beliefs, for example. And if you're the type of voter that is motivated by that, and there's surely some in Ohio, just like everywhere else, and you see these welfare ads, and that might tip you a little bit towards Romney, and he could pick up some voters here and there for that. On the other hand, there's, of course, some voters are very turned off by that sort of thing.
All right, so here's what we're going to do. In a couple of minutes, we're going to get Lynn back up here because you guys have worked together, I understand. We're going to get you up, and we're going to talk about this with your questions. So if you do have questions, let's get you guys to the microphones. Please come on down, and we'll get as many of you in as we can. But before we bring Lynn up, I wanted to ask you about candidates' appearances and you know how intelligent they seem to be. That stuff matters as well, right? I mean, there's more to it than just you know running those welfare ads.
Yeah, sure. I mean, of course, candidates can make or break themselves. themselves. Yeah. And it has to do with what they say and what they don't say. Now, Lynn, of course, has studied this a lot, and she'll tell you that, yeah, what candidates say during elections, that can, you know, that can change people's minds. Now, right. What we do know, and Lynn said this, and this is absolutely true, is when it comes down to it, Democrats vote for Democrats and Republicans vote for Republicans.
Right.
And that's the most important thing. And it doesn't matter how good-looking a candidate is or what they say, it's going to be really hard to change those people to vote a different way. But on the edges, these and places like Ohio come down to it, around these margins, these few voters, certain things people say, certain things people do, yeah, that can make a difference.
So what do you see in terms of minority voting this time around? You mentioned that as an issue.
Yeah. Well, you know, I said it was all about identity, right? And, of course, minority voters in the United States, especially African Americans, have somebody they can identify with. And that is turning African Americans out to the polls. And it probably still will. This is a very big deal for the African American community. And that's a very big deal for the Democratic Party, because that's a huge part of their base that is being motivated by their presidential candidate.
All right, let's do this. Lynn, come on up, because there's some things I want to ask you. And while she's coming up, I need you guys to come down to the microphones. I mean, Jeremy and I can go all day, so don't worry about that. But, yeah, snuggle nice and close into that microphone. And let me ask you about these undecided voters. Is it true that this whole shooting match is going to come down to, like, 6 counties in Florida, 3 counties in Ohio, like 200 voters in Colorado, and maybe a handful in Nevada? I mean, is that really the way it's going to break out?
And the 10 people here who are...
Yeah, well, that's right. The three of you who raised your hands.
I think this is a great frame for the media because it's very dramatic.
Yeah.
But, and you know, to an extent, how these people decide will be important. But A, they're probably not going to decide that differently from the way everyone else decided. Okay, so there is this big national conformity in how the votes swing from one year to another. But secondly, the vote does also depend on all of those Republicans and Democrats we've been talking about and whether they show up at the polls. So turnout is a big deal, and the campaigns spend a lot of money trying to mobilize and make sure that you don't wake up on election day and forget that you have a dentist appointment and have to go to the dry cleaner.
Ryan Enos, if my neighbor votes, am I more likely to vote?
Yes, absolutely.
Huh.
And Ryan, is it really, is the location where you live still that important in an age of where these candidates and campaigns can target you on Facebook and Twitter and figure out so much more about you than where your actual location is?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been experiments and lots of experiments. I've done some of them myself where we can move people's proclivity to vote by, for example, telling them whether or not their neighbors vote, by showing them maps of their neighborhood and saying whether their neighbors around them vote, things like that. And it all has to do with location. People are very tied to where they live, and it's a very, very big part of their identity, and they're very concerned with who lives around them.
Raise your hand if you feel slightly used by all this, right? Right? Yes, sir. Tell us, up to the microphone, if you would, tell us who you are, where you're from, and what your question is.
My name's George. I originally grew up in Columbus, and I've lived in Cleveland here for 15 years. My question on the economic front has to do with, I think the Obama campaign is painting Romney as sort of a poster boy for the hedge fund and the financial revolution that we've had in this country in the past 20 or 30 years, that he's an architect of this new post-industrial economy that we live in. And I wonder if you've collected any data or if you have any viewpoint on how that's going to play specifically in Ohio, which has had a big manufacturing depression and a big change in the demographics of the workforce.
Yeah, you bet. Ryan, why don't you take that one first?
People do identify with their income group. And of course, when Obama says these kinds of things, we believe this probably would play with people in Ohio. Inequality is something that does motivate people. You know, it's hard for a person to know how well they're doing unless they can see how well other people are doing. So if you tell somebody they're poor, that doesn't resonate until they know other people are rich. And in a certain respect, Romney was a very bad choice for the Republicans in that respect, especially in a place like Ohio. And you can understand why Obama would push on things like that.
Is that why Ohio is so different in the polls right now than Florida? Ohio, Obama has a much bigger edge in the current polls than he does in a state like Florida.
Yes, you'd believe absolutely that can make a huge difference. That is because he's speaking to these voters that don't identify with Romney. And he probably has more of those in Ohio than he does in other places.
All right. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Elliot. I'm also a Cleveland resident. You mentioned polls, and this is an interesting question, because if you go by what the polls say today, the election's already won. What's the likelihood that either party or the Republicans in this case can change what the polls say today?
Lynn?
It's not impossible, But it is on. It is.
Come on. There's 5 weeks left. There are debates. There's zillions of dollars of advertising to spend. And you're telling me we're done?
Well, okay. I don't want to say this as a blanket statement that this is true in every year.
Yeah.
But I think in this particular year, I think it's going to be very difficult for Mitt Romney to overcome the gap that he has already established. And a single event, a good debate performance, is not going to do it. Now, that's not true in general, but in this year.
Very quickly, the importance of early voting, which starts in Ohio, in 2 days, right? Tomorrow. Yeah, the importance of early voting. Either one of you have a thought on that?
It's a game changer, I think, for candidates, for campaigns, for us and studying elections. 50%, maybe slightly more, of Americans will vote early this year. And that's a big number. It's unusual. It's all changing.
Lynn Beverick and Ryan Enos from
Thanks
Harvard.
Thank you
so much,
really
guys.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Good stuff. The economy with a capital E, gross domestic product, debt, trade deficit, you know it. And then there's your economy. A conversation with a small business owner right here in Cleveland.
And what the candidates are not talking about, the silent issues that matter. Stay with us for more of the Marketplace Election Roadshow. Factors in a voter's decision this election year is the economy, of course. So to get a sense of how the economy is doing here in Ohio, we've got a toy store owner here with us. And you can learn a lot about the economy in a toy store. Of course, there's Monopoly, which teaches you that if you own all the railroads, you will be able to charge people an arm and a leg to travel. It also teaches that if you're the banker, you can cheat if you want to. It's a whole nother show. But right now we've got Steve Presser. He's the owner of Big Fun Toys here in Cleveland. Welcome.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, you're a small business owner. I want to first start by asking you, how is business right now?
It's starting to pick up. You know, business has changed dramatically in the last 10 years. I've been in business 22 years, and so there's so many different factors that come into play. You know, obviously this forum is about recession and the down in economy, but, you know, factors for the small business owner are, you know, big box, the internet, changing markets, changing neighborhoods, so adjustment. But I, you know, for the first time in a long time, I'm starting to see a change in the market.
And what do you think is the reason for that? As a voter, as a small business owner, but also as a voter, what do you think is the reason for that? Is it an outside factor? Is it something that has happened from Washington, from Ohio, because you've got a Republican governor and a Democratic president right now? Who do you thank if you're seeing a recovery right now, if anybody?
The community. I think that's... So, as a small business owner, I'm an independent business owner, so I'm a mom and pop. And so, for us, and that's the community of mom and pops out there, we're starting to see a swing towards supporting your local independent businesses. So that factor is something that's probably different than most when you do the economic numbers abroad. You know, the Targets, the Walmarts, those are economic factor numbers that you take into consideration. These are different ones.
Are you seeing different customers now than you did before, or is it the same people who held back a little bit and now they've come back in and started spending again?
Yes and yes. We're seeing both. We're seeing people are coming into my store who now are spending money. We call them tourists, the people before, who would come in to watch and participate but not purchase. And we understand that because, you know, there's only so much money to go through, and if you have to pay your electric bill or your gas bill or you get a whoopee cushion at Big Fun, there's that, you know, we understand what's more important.
You mentioned whoopee cushion. What's the hot toy right now, by the way?
Oh, the hot toy. Well, actually, for my store specifically, it's 80s toys. It's the Transformers, it's G.I. Joe's, it's Care Bear, Strawberry Shortcake, which are, you know, American Greetings Cleveland product.
That's a nostalgic factor, or what's going on?
Absolutely, in my store, yes, because Nostalgia never goes out of style. So what's popular today, 10 years from now, is going to be the 90s toys.
Is popular among kids or among adults who want to go back and buy the toys that they had when they were kids?
I like to think we're all kids, but it's really the adults. But now they're having children, so they're buying it for their generation. But the hot toys, you say hot toys, it's like the Doctor Who product, which is really, really popular.
I want to find out what's in this box.
I'd like to know what's in there, too. I brought a couple products. Since it's a political year, I brought you some fun things. These are politically incorrect.
Oh, there you go.
These are cigarette dispensing both an elephant and a donkey. So regardless of what your political beliefs are, and you can look this from both a positive or a negative standpoint, but, you know, it's forever your political party.
Those are for the adults, I assume, that are coming in.
Oh, yeah. And then for you and Kai, of course, you have to get something that's important because we're filming and we're talking here. It's the Cleveland You Gotta Be Tough t-shirt. And this says it all. Because really, you know, it's the smog-filled skyline. And this shirt was designed 30-some years ago. But really, Clevelanders, we are tough. And we're seeing that, you know, we're the resurgence.
Okay, let me get back to the big issue here, which is the reputation of Ohio and Cleveland around the country is a city that has gone through some hard times recently. The stories that made news all around the country were, of course, about LeBron James a couple of years ago and the fact that he was a real hope for Cleveland and the Cleveland economy that didn't come through. I walked down Euclid Street here in Cleveland this morning, and there are more empty businesses than there are full businesses. So how can you tell me that things are getting better? Or are they just starting from such a low point that it's going to take a while for them to get back
up? I can easily tell you. You know, like every neighborhood around the country, there are some gap-toothed areas. And so the pocket that you were in is one of the areas that's going to be the next development. So Cleveland right now is, you know, you ask about what happens. You know, we have all the famous phrases that have happened over the years. But Clevelanders really are tough. And we're born from a lot of immigrant families. And family's important. Community's important. Business is important. And we get knocked down, we get back up again. And right now, we're starting to see a change, and it's really important, and it's nice. And I've got two kids that have moved back to Cleveland. So we were talked about the brain drain from Cleveland. We now have the brain gain happening. So I think it's starting to happen. Our ethnic neighborhoods in the past have now become cool, hip neighborhoods, and you're starting to see a resurgence. We have such a strong economy in the health industry. Our downtown, if you went a couple more blocks the other way, you see Cleveland State, which is putting residential community, and they're doing incredible things. And you drive down, you say, oh my God, it's not a suitcase school anymore. You've got Case Western Reserve that's growing leaps and bounds. You've got Moca, which is developing the University Circle area. You got neighborhoods like Coventry, where I'm at, where I live two blocks and I can walk to work. You've got pockets that are doing real well. It's the sum of the parts that's going to make Cleveland really special. And that's why we're starting to attract the next generation. And that's the importance.
Steve Presser of the Big Fun Toy Store, thanks so much. Thank you, Steve. So for months, if not the last couple of years, we've been hearing about key issues like jobs, taxes, government spending. But what else is on the mind of voters? What's missing from the current political debate?
So we got some help. Here with us on stage are David Malpas. He's the executive editor here at WCPN IdeaStream. Henry Gomez is a political reporter for The Plain Dealer. And ML Schulze is the news director at WKSU Public Radio. Thanks you guys so much for coming out tonight. Really appreciate it. Schulze, I want to start with you, and I want to talk about that thing that we've been talking about a lot on Marketplace, actually, the amount of money that's in this campaign. It's a big deal in media circles. There's much ooh and ah. Is it missing from the popular debate? I mean, are people interested in how much money is in this campaign?
I think they are because they're just fascinated with it. How can it be worth it? I mean, I think all of us look at our own budgets and our own lives and think we would never spend that much money on that kind of long shot proportionally. And it is fascinating. It's also kind of neat to be wanted so much.
Do you feel wanted? I mean, do you like that? No, that's actually a serious question, right? Because everybody raised their hands when they said they were done with the advertising. Yeah, so you guys are happy to not be wanted then, right? Yeah. All right. I'm sorry, Schultz. Keep going.
In a little bit of an extension of that, you know, the latest polls have come out, and they've been showing 5, 6, 7, 8% leads for Mr. Obama, and some up to 10. And I almost felt this weekend a little bit of, at my neighbor's house, because it was like, they're not going to love us anymore.
Wow.
Now, Henry, you recently interviewed both candidates, and you asked them about highways and roads that they were driving on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the issues that we felt wasn't getting a whole lot of coverage that deserved more was infrastructure and transportation infrastructure. It gets talked about in the, you know, interim years in a presidency, and the president spent a lot of time talking about it a year ago with his American Jobs Act. But once that stalled out in Congress, we weren't hearing a lot about it. And here in Cleveland, we have some projects that need some money. We have the Interbelt Bridge, which is a major artery into downtown Cleveland. It took the Republican governor to go out there and find a private-public partnership. Actually, he hasn't found it yet, but this is the current move that they're making to try to get some money into this, find a private sector partner to go ahead and build it and finance it, and then the state will pay it back with interest in the long run. And we wanted to talk about those issues.
But this is not something that the candidates are talking about in their daily ads. Is that something, do you think, if they were to do that in a state like Ohio, that people would care? People would want to hear about plans to improve infrastructure across the country?
I think it depends on how they approach it. The one thing that we didn't really get into in our story the other day is, I mean, infrastructure projects and transportation projects mean jobs. I mean, they're short-term jobs in the short term, but they also mean in the long run you're going to have these major arteries, you know, stable and delivering goods from point A to point B. So I do think that especially in Ohio, where you have a big construction industry here in the northeastern part of the state, yes, I do think that that resonates. But, you know, it is a bit of a Homer issue for us. I think it's a major issue in all big urban centers across the country that doesn't get talked about as much as it should.
David Amalpas, I wanted to ask you about healthcare. We're hearing a lot about the money that President Obama is going to take out of Medicare, the $716 billion, that, you know, the Romney-Ryan plan, all of that stuff. What, though, about health care is not being talked about?
Well, the Affordable Health Care Act, basically the first part of it, affordable. Will people be able to afford health care as it continues to increase in cost? And I think we know that the act is sort of a first step in terms of controlling costs, but it really doesn't go very far. If you look at employers over the last 6 years, 40% increase in their costs for health care for their employees, and the employee share of that has gone up 80% in the last 6 years. We're really not talking about that. The candidates aren't talking about it. And secondly, I think there's a broader issue that's as much societal as political, and that is, excuse me, what is the responsibility of employers and individuals to improve their own health? And how do we get there? Is it incentives? Is it financial pain that we inflict? Or what do we do? Is it just a case of awareness? Yeah. What more do we have to do?
Yeah. We're going to take your questions for these guys as well. So come on down if you have something you want to ask them. Schultze, the number one thing that's not being talked about that you think we need to be addressing, what is it? Number one thing.
We need to talk about what we're afraid of. There's an undercurrent in so much, and it's guiding so many of our decisions, fear. Even coming down to the election, I'm out interviewing people who are going to vote, talking about how they're afraid somebody else is going to steal the election. It's reached that level where people are just feeling like they need to be afraid. They need to be afraid for their own futures. They need to be afraid for their kids' futures. They need to be afraid of who they live next to.
Is fear like a good way to run a democracy? I don't know.
It's a terrible way to run a democracy. And I don't think it's a necessary way. I'll take some responsibility as part of the media, too. I think we have emphasized the things that make people afraid. And disproportionately,
you mean we like conflict in the media? Is that what you're saying? David, let me ask you, by the way, your number one issue.
Well, I think I haven't heard anything from the candidates about what they would do to improve this anemic offense of the Cleveland Browns.
Talk about really fear.
Totally dodged it. But I do think that the healthcare issue is the main thing that I think has just gone unreported. Romney took it off the table by basically saying I would veto the or repeal the Affordable Health Care Act. So there's not a lot to debate about right. The particulars going forward.
Henry, what about you? Besides infrastructure,
I think
and the Browns for crying out loud.
I would have said the Indians, but poverty is another one that I think gets the short shrift. We talk so much about the middle class. That's how you run a campaign. You gear it toward the middle class.
We're having a piece on that in about three more minutes. Chrissy Clark is going to give us a whiz-bang story.
I'm looking forward to that. But, I mean, Governor Romney's comments about the 47%, he's getting a lot of flack for that. They were, you know, I think his word was inelegant, but there's some factual, it's based in fact, and we talk about, we break people out by groups, and we look at this middle, but we're not talking about in Ohio the 15% of people who are living in poverty. We actually wrote a line in a story this year announcing that figure, saying that it was relatively good news because it was the same as last year. And to me, that's an issue that's also not getting its due.
Yeah. Come on, sir, do you have a question? Tell us who you are and where you're from.
Paul Mashenko from Solon, Ohio. Like George, I'm a Columbus native that ended up here in Cleveland.
Excellent.
So here's my question. I love this topic. Is the media in general doing enough to ask the hard questions of all the candidates this go around?
No. We're also not given a lot of opportunity to. The candidates are packaged and they're handled, and you're lucky to get them to glance you in the eye, let alone ask the questions. Does that mean we should stop demanding it? No. Henry was able to find his moments twice in one day, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and
nice
and
job, man.
Thank you. And I hope right.
But here's the interesting part about it, right? It's not that the media have the chance. They are granted the opportunity. It's dispensed as a royal favor, right? I mean, how many hoops did you have to jump through to get both of those guys?
Yeah, it's tough to get these interviews. I've been asking the Romney campaign for months to get a sit down with him, and he's in Ohio every other week. So it's not like it's a lack of opportunity. And it finally happened. I got 8 minutes, and you have to, and trust me, the night before was a nerve-wracking experience. You're sitting in a hotel room, and you're trying to come up with the 2, 3, maybe if you're lucky, 4 questions you're going to get to ask the guy. And it's you want to make them count.
So we had Obama on the broadcast in October. We had 48 hours to get ready. Everybody and their grandma sent me notes and things that I should ask him. I'm like, my head is going to explode if you people don't let me on. That's almost literally what happened. Sir, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Glade Pauly. I'm from Hudson, and I work and have worked for 28 years in the healthcare industry as a manufacturer's rep. My costs have gone down. I'm selling product for less than I sold it 28 years ago. My customers, who are physicians, are getting less in reimbursement per procedure and so forth than what they've gotten. And yet we keep getting, and I'm also a self-employed businessman, so I see my costs going up for my health care coverage, wondering where all the costs are. And I've been reading the Plain Dealer stories with interest about the problems with the billing. You know, one of the things we could do is we could, I think, carve out so much if we would just use one set of bills, one set of codes. Every insurance company's got their own things. And then we got the federal government that keeps changing things. I wish I was in the medical billing printing form.
Yeah. So let me see if I can turn that into a question for you, David Malpas, and ask you whether you think, you know, Obamacare aside, but based on what this gentleman said, is there hope that we will be able to, as they said during that debate 2 years ago, bend that cost curve based on all this infrastructure stuff?
Well, I think you raise a really good point about the series that the Plain Dealer did on billing and just how many errors that there are in bills. And I think there are multiple reasons for that, as the Plain Dealer has explored. One of the ways, the tactics that I think hospital systems are using these days to drive up those bills is to have you go to a facility outside of the main hospital, but they have now called it an affiliate of the hospital. And so you're paying hospital rates for what is generally would be considered an office visit. And that varies from hospital to hospital system. But it's one of the problems that, again, hasn't been addressed yet by conversation in Congress, by what the federal government's requiring, or what the state's doing.
David Malpas from WCPN here in Cleveland, ML Schultze, news director at WKSU, and, of course, Henry Gomez, political reporter at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Thanks all very much.
Thanks, you guys, very much. Good job. Thank you, David. show.
Politics 101 is coming up next. Never make a promise you can't keep. But here is something, Kai, that I can guarantee you is going to happen. In Wednesday's presidential debate, you're going to hear one phrase over and over again from the president and from Governor Romney: the middle class. We're going to explore the real economic story behind that group and its financial prospects.
Also, a drink to go with your politics, a cocktail, and a history of political cartooning, the story behind the donkey and the elephant. All that coming up on the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow. We'll be right back. This is what you call live radio. So what we would do right about here is vamp for a second. And so I will. The question, of course, is which story I'm going to tell, and is it going to be appropriate for a live audience? Also, we're streaming this on the web, by the way. When I said drink, I didn't actually mean a drink. We're going to have a recipe for a drink for you. Rico Galliano, who's one of our culture, he runs a culture radio show called The Dinner Party. He's going to be up in just a second. But while Chrissy's getting set here, are we set? Yes? Charleston, is this going to work? All right. So we'll just get this show on the road. Here we go. There have been, by my very rough count, something like, I don't know what, a zillion sound bites in the course of this campaign. And there is still a little more than a month to go, 35 or so days until Election Day. The candidates have been talking about anything and everything they think will resonate with voters, including the things that might affect the broadest chunk of Americans. And this is where Henry Gomez comes in.
Middle-class families.
The middle class of America.
The middle class.
The middle class.
But here's the thing. Who are they talking about? Yes, the middle class is what? Between rich and poor, right? If you want to get more specific, about $39,000 to a plus or minus $118,000 a year. But those are just the numbers when it comes to almost everything else. What kind of jobs, what kind of lifestyles, what kind of attitudes the middle class enjoys. Middle class can mean a lot of different things depending on who's doing the talking. So, to help answer those questions is Chrissy Clark. She's a senior reporter at our Wealth and Poverty Desk. She's based out of Los Angeles. She is freshly mic'd, so she's ready to go. And it does seem like, what, you've been shopping, I guess?
Yes, before I broke my mic, I went shopping.
Yes. Oh, you break it, you buy it, right? Isn't that the rule when you're
exactly.
shopping?
Yeah. So, you know, I figured that the middle class is the great consumer class, so right. It seemed appropriate to go shopping.
Boom, boom. So uh-huh. Here we go.
Bad what? Joke.
Yes. All right,
no, so actually, before I got to the politician's definition of what middle class is, I figured I should go to the people. We're a democracy, right? So we went out onto the street to ask people from around the country, including here in Cleveland, what it takes to be middle class. And I did some shopping based on that list. I have all of the stuff in these bags.
To be clear here, you have the definition of middle class in three shopping bags.
I do.
All right. Hit me. Make me smart.
Okay. So, perhaps not surprising, the number one thing people said you need to be middle class is one of these.
You got a job.
A good paying job.
That brings home a decent wage.
Got it. So it's a paycheck, okay?
Yes, yes. You also, not surprisingly, probably need to own one of these.
House.
Home. Roof over your head.
A house. Got it. Okay. Very good.
And I thought this one was a little dated, but some people said you still need to have one of these.
White picket fence.
I love that. How'd you get that on the airplane? All right. White picket fence. Good. Okay.
So, what else have we got in here? Oh, you need some of these.
Some kids, maybe one or two kids. A vacation a year.
Credit card.
May have a dog.
Woof. Okay. Woof. All right. Very good.
I thought this one was cool. So you also need some of this.
Freedom to spend time with my loved ones.
Wow.
And not have to work a second job.
Statue of Liberty. Okay, good. I get
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I thought that was nice. But yeah. Back to those jobs that last woman was talking about, that is where things get a little tricky, because what is a middle class job?
White collar.
Doctor. Lawyer.
As well as blue collar.
Police, fire, teachers.
Skilled trades.
Auto worker.
And from there, things start to get even harder to pin down. For example, most people agreed a middle class family definitely needs...
car.
But how many? What kind?
Two cars.
Not a brand new car.
Maybe buy a car every couple years.
And then take education. Also a huge range of options.
A high school diploma.
College degree.
In fact, people couldn't even really agree on just the basic philosophy of what it means to be middle class. Is it this?
The ability to provide the necessities of life.
Food, a can of, what is that, Campbell's soup?
Campbell's soup.
All right.
Andy Warhol.
Cream of what?
Chicken noodle.
All right, good.
I went with the old-fashioned.
You splurge?
Is it that, or is it this?
Able to buy things not because they need to, but because they want to.
I thought these were so cute.
So I draw the line at shoes, okay? Because here's the thing. We have not yet gotten to the politics of this thing, and I'm baffled. You roll up this stuff into one big kludge, and it's just confusing.
Right, and that's right. Because it is confusing. And part of why is that right now, at this moment in history, as we speak, the definition of middle class is changing, not because of the Great Recession only. There are deeper economic forces at work, and people are worried.
It's like middle class is disappearing.
It ain't but rich and poor right now.
There's really no in between.
It's not what it used to be, basically.
And a lot of the things that we took for granted about what the middle class means, people feel those things are being swept away.
Swept away, okay. With the broom. Okay. All right. I'm not actually sure we rehearsed that part, but that's all right. But I get the symbolism, right? Bye-bye middle class as we knew it. Let me ask you one thing, though. Can we play that last bit of tape, that last woman? Play that again.
It's not what it used to be, basically.
Okay. What did the middle class used to be? If you look at all that stuff, it's the 1950s version, right? White picket fence, 1.7 children, car, dog, mortgage, the whole deal. What's the actual truth? What did the middle class used to be?
Well, it's funny you should ask me about the history of the middle class, Kai, because I happen to have brought with me a little thing that I call...
Great moments in middle class history, a PowerPoint presentation.
All right, this part we did rehearse.
The dance also I
That's
rehearsed.
That's right.
So, okay, are you ready?
I am.
Okay, you guys ready? So we're going to begin going way, way back. One of the first references to the middle class by an American was Thomas Paine, who in 1792. No bell bottoms yet.
That's right.
Okay, who wrote in 1792...
A poll tax was levied. It excited, as it naturally must, universal detestation among the poor and middle classes.
I thought that it was kind of funny that even back then, the middle class stereotype was someone annoyed by taxes. But the middle class that Paine was talking about does not look like you might expect. It's not white collar. It's not blue collar. Back then, the middle class looked like this.
The yeoman farmer.
That's writer Michael Lind, that voice you just heard. He wrote a book about the economic history of the United States called Land of Promise. And he said, once upon a time, our founding fathers realized that if they were going to make their crazy idea of a democracy work, they needed something that didn't really exist anywhere in the world yet.
A dominant middle class who, because of a certain amount of economic security and economic independence, is capable of playing various roles that society in a republic demands, whether it's as a voter or as a juror.
And since there were a lot of farmers running around back then, they seemed like good candidates for the job. But Lind argues these guys didn't naturally become economically independent and secure overnight. What you might call America's first middle class didn't just happen. It came about through a series of choices we made as a country.
An artificial creation of private sector and public sector policies, distribution of federal land to farmers through the Homestead Act, elementary public education.
These are things that America invented to help support the new middle class ideal.
Chrissy, what happened, though, to the idea of the yeoman farmer? I mean, where'd that guy go?
Right. Well, by the late 1800s, as you probably remember from history class, new technology and machines meant we needed fewer farmers. The rest headed to factories and cities where conditions weren't so hot, and they were, to say the least, not getting paid a whole lot. And as Americans watched the yeoman farmer ideal unravel before their eyes, they started freaking out. Like, what is happening to the middle class that we built this country on?
Which is a little bit like today, right? I mean, the same thing is happening, and it resonates with the whole Thomas Paine thing and being annoyed about taxes.
Exactly. Yeah. And so back then, in response, Michael Lind says, a lot of thinkers at the time on the left and the right and the center said, we have to do something, not just because it seemed like a nice idea, but because people had this theory.
A stable democracy requires a dominant middle class. If you had a desperate low-wage majority that lacked property, that lacked any stake in society, they would turn to demagogues.
So the next American experiment was to figure out a way to bring those low-wage factory workers into the middle class fold. And Michael Lind says that required a whole new set of public and private policies.
Labor unions, minimum wage laws, minimum hours laws, the GI Bill, the home mortgage financial system where the government backed low interest loans to create the first mass middle class of homeowners in human history.
And voila, a new version of the middle class was born.
And you fast forward to today, right? And we're seeing the same thing. There's globalization. There's fewer factories in this country, fewer manufacturing jobs. I mean, all of that stuff rolls into one thing.
Right. And Lind argues that we're actually at a very similar moment in history right now to that moment 100 years ago when we were shifting off the farms. There's a kind of void where the bulk of middle class used to be. We haven't figured out how to fill it, and there's a lot of anxiety again.
So you know this is the election roadshow, right?
I do.
Okay.
So you can't see my colors.
That's right. So let's get back to that idea of the middle class and the election and President Obama and Governor Romney. They are talking a lot about the middle class, as Henry Gomez said. What are they saying, and what's their vision of the middle class and its future?
Well, of course, each guy kind of wants you to think that they're talking about you when they talk about saving the middle class. But there are clues to how each of them see it. Obama really focuses on the importance of education.
Education was the gateway to opportunity for me. It was the gateway for Michelle. It was the gateway for most of you. And now, more than ever, it is the gateway to a middle-class life.
As for Romney, he focuses more on small businesses.
We will champion small businesses, America's engine of job growth. That means reducing taxes on business, not raising them. It means simplifying and modernizing the regulations that hurt small business the most.
Is there a way, Chrissy, because those two don't seem to be simpatico with each other, is there a way to tell which guy is right?
Well, Michael Lind, the guy that we heard from earlier, has a pretty provocative answer to that, and it kind of throws everything up in the air.
Conservatives tend to recommend entrepreneurialism. Progressives tend to want to expand the number of people who go to college. The problem is the math simply does not work.
And Lind means the math on both sides. On the one hand, he points out that only about 10% of Americans are self-employed. On the other hand, 70% of Americans don't have college degrees.
70, that's huge.
Yeah, it's a big number. Yeah. So as wonderful as the ideals of education and entrepreneurship may be, neither of those trends is going to change overnight. So Lind worries that in the meantime, neither party is being really realistic about the bulk of Americans who won't be small business owners or white-collar professionals.
So if you can't do one from column A or one from column B, right, if those two aren't going to work, what's it going to be? What are the jobs going to be?
Well, Lind and a lot of economists say that at least for the foreseeable future, most of the jobs will be ones that involve something like this.
The broom again. All right, good. Help me understand that.
Yeah, so we're talking about jobs in the service sector, janitors, home health care workers, restaurant servers. And Lind says the trick is going to be how to turn those kinds of jobs into middle class jobs.
Yeah, but you know what? You've done those stories, right? And you know that those are not the jobs everybody wants. They're not the most celebrated. They're not the most desired in this economy, right?
Right. And in fact, each time, though, that the country has shifted from one economic sector to the next, Americans have felt the same way.
Farmers in the early 19th century looked down on factory work. A century later, the factory worker on the assembly line becomes the symbol of the new middle class. There's a lot of fear now that the jobs of the future will be degrading and demeaning, and it's a genuine challenge to upgrade jobs which today tend to be very poorly paid and to be without benefits.
But Lind says if we really want to be thinking about the future of the middle class, That is what we should be talking about this election.
All right, before I let you go, I have to bring up something that Schulze was talking about, this idea of fear. Michael Lind said the same thing, fear of the way this is turning out. What's your guess that in the 35 days that we have left, there will be a rational conversation about any of these things we've been talking about today?
Well, I will put that to these great people in the audience. I mean, is this something that you guys are thinking about as you head to the ballot?
Show of hands, right? I mean, are you thinking about the middle class in this country? All right, so, all right, that's pretty good, actually. Now, how many of you identify yourselves as middle class? Yeah, okay.
How many of you don't identify
yourselves right?
Better as middle
question.
Class?
Oh. Better, yeah,
talk
better
to me
question.
Afterwards. I want to interview you.
All right. There we go. Chrissy Clark from the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Chrissy, thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks very much.
Elections are often about things more symbolic than substantive, as you know. In fact, the candidates themselves are actually kinds of symbols of their parties and what their parties stand for. But there are two political symbols of the parties themselves that are really a little bewildering.
And here to make sense of them for us is Rico Galliano, who, along with his contributor Brendan Francis Noonan, hosts the public radio culture show The Dinner Party. Hi, Rico.
Hello.
So,
he practiced that.
Hello.
All right. So tell us why you're here, first of all.
Well, I was here to blow your minds with the historical tale of the Democratic donkey and the Republican elephant. Uh-huh. But Mr. Pressler beat me to it. Thanks
that's
a
right.
lot, dude.
That's right. No cigarettes involved in this one, right?
No. Sir Walter Raleigh invented that. On our show, we have a signature segment where we tell you a tale from history. And then we pair it with a cocktail that is themed after that history. Don't get excited. We don't have a cocktail for you guys. Sorry. Either, I guess, because it's a beer town. but we do have a gift cocktail theme that we will give you later. But we did recently on our show the history of the Democratic donkey and the Republican elephant, the animal familiars of the two parties.
Which are so curious. I mean,
Yeah, especially the donkey, right? Why a donkey? You would think that if you had a national party, you would choose something.
You're probably not going to pick a jackass.
Yeah, probably not.
Hey.
You'd pick like a falcon, you know, or like a tiger. Or a tiger riding on a falcon over a purple mountain.
So why did they choose it, Rico?
This may not come as a surprise to you. They're not idiots. They didn't. It was foisted upon them by a Republican. It was a Republican named Thomas Nast. He was one of the famed political cartoonists of his time. And in January, I think it was 1790. I could look at those, but I'm not going to.
Not 1970.
Not 1970. That was a different time.
How about 1870?
I learned. No, in 1790, so he had a... he wasn't the first guy, by the way, to use a donkey for a Democrat, but he sort of popularized it with this cartoon. There it is.
So just to correct the historical record, 1870, Thomas Nast.
Oh, 1870. Yeah. See, we don't know dates. We're business reporters. So in this, there's a very complicated history behind this. But basically what's happening is the donkey here is representing a certain brand of Democratic editor of newspaper. And they had recently disrespected a Republican who had died. So here in this cartoon, you see the Democratic donkey labeled the Copperhead Press. And it is a donkey kicking the corpse of a dead lion. So if you think that election rhetoric is pretty heated now, like go back to 1870, did you say?
1870.
There you go.
That's when it started. So there's a picture of this for those watching on the live stream. It's at marketplace.org on our website.
That is correct. So, and everybody got into this. They thought that it was a rather startling image. And other cartoonists started using the donkey to represent Democrats, and pretty soon it just stuck.
So this cartoon and this guy Nast was that important, that it actually created a symbol that lasted until now?
Yeah, he was hugely important. He was probably the most powerful political cartoonist ever, and he invented actually a lot of American icons that we know today. The Santa Claus that we have come to know, the roly-poly Santa Claus with the beard, he basically drew that.
That's awesome. That.
He also gave Uncle Sam his goatee. For some reason, he thought that Uncle Sam was a beatnik. I don't understand
how he could do that. And it lasted. All right, so that's Uncle Sam and Santa Claus, and more importantly, the Democratic Donald. Monkey. What yes. about the elephant? How'd we get there?
Would it surprise you to know that Nass did it?
Yes, it would.
The same guy.
Why?
Same guy?
Yes, it was the same dude. And this was, I think, a few years later. Again, not the first guy to use the elephant, but the guy who popularized it. And he did it with, do we have that one? This cartoon, which also features a Democratic donkey. This time, the donkey is dressed as a lion pretty badly. And wow. he's frightening all of the other animals in the forest, including over here an elephant who is labeled the GOP vote. And it is so scared that it is stampeding off a cliff into a chasm labeled chaos.
Wow.
Again, very understated, very calm, rational kind of imagery. And it is interesting that, I mean, he's a Republican and he is portraying them as a coward. But it is, I will note, a large animal that doesn't need to be frightened.
Yeah.
Which may explain why the Republicans have officially adopted this animal symbol, whereas the Democrats never officially actually adopted it.
It's not the falcon riding tiger, but it's kind of cool.
Yeah,
right?
They'll take it. Like, please don't make us rats or cockroaches. We'll just fine.
Could have been. Who knows?
So before you go, Rico, you've got a gift. You promised it a moment ago. You said it was not an actual cocktail.
But you can make it at home. There is a cocktail that goes with this history that was made for us by a Washington, D.C. bar, appropriately enough, called the Passenger D.C. It is called the Jackass Neck. Based on the horse's neck, which is a classic cocktail, and we have the recipe for it on the tables outside, I think, or it may be handed to you as you go out. And it's on marketplace.org.
Rico Galliano, who with his buddy Brendan Francis Noonan hosts the dinner party. You should listen to it. It's pretty good. And that amazingly was an hour. That's the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow. Nancy Fargali sitting right over there, and Devin Maverick Robbins back in Los Angeles produced our show with help from Justin Ho. Today he's sitting right over there. Charlton Thorpe, the redheaded guy, is the engineer. Special thanks, of course, to WCPN for hosting us and to this great audience here in Cleveland, Ohio.
A couple more names for you. The executive producer of Marketplace is our boss, Deborah Clark. The Marketplace general manager is J.J. Yor.
We have to get them in the broadcast. That's the rule, right?
That's right. Or we don't get any paychecks.
That's right.
Be sure to check out Marketplace.org. You're going to find stories, maps, and a lot more about this presidential election. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.